This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Chris Berrow, and at 14 GMT on Monday the 3rd of July, these are our main stories. Israel justifies its military operation on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, saying it's a sanctuary city for terror. France's president tells protesters to go home after a teenager shot dead by police triggered nearly a week of unrest. And what to do about pollution caused by ships? Also in this podcast...
Hi Barbie.
Why the upcoming Barbie film is being banned in Vietnam. We begin this podcast in the Palestinian city of Jenin. At 1 o'clock in the morning local time, the Israeli army launched a surprise attack on the refugee camp in the city on what it called terrorist infrastructure involving drones, troops and missile attacks. A senior government official said that the goal of this extensive operation is to end Jenin's role as a sanctuary city for terror, and it will last as long as it needs to. Israel's Foreign Minister Eli Cohen says they do not plan to widen the operation and that Israel's target is the militant groups operating there and not the Palestinian people.
We are striking the terrorism hub with a great strength. I want to emphasize that we don't have a fight with the Palestinians. Actually, our fight is with the proxies of Iran in our region, which is mainly with the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, both terrorist organizations which financed by Iran. And Iran's target is to escalate our region.
I spoke to our correspondent, Yolan Nell, who's in Jenin.
We've had the loud thuds of explosions, repeated volleys of gunfire, and on top of that, there's just this kind of constant whir of drones in the sky above us. It was an Israeli military drone strike that started things off just after 1 o'clock this morning. The Israeli military saying its intention was to surprise the militants who are based in Jenin refugee camp by striking right at the core of the camp. They say that they were targeting an apartment being used as a command and control centre by the Jenin Brigades. That's a group of different Palestinian militant factions that operates as one unit inside the camp. There are hundreds of armed gunmen operating inside the camp, we know. And they say also that apartment had been used in recent months as a safe haven for Palestinians, even from other parts of the West Bank, who had carried out attacks against Israelis and then fled to Jenin. And they said they wanted to break the safe haven mentality of militants and also described the Jenin refugee camp as becoming like a hornet's nest. Now, there have been some very feisty comments coming out from Palestinian militant groups, Hamas calling on people throughout the West Bank to stand by Jenin to defend its people in order to thwart the enemy's plan. Those are the words of Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader. The Jenin battalion saying that it has high morale. It's going to fight what it calls the occupation forces with their last breath and bullet. We have heard some gunfire very close to where we are in the centre of Jenin, where otherwise the streets around us are completely empty, very quiet. There's a general strike. But yes, an intense ongoing operation. The Israeli military not saying how long it will last for. They said simply as long as needed.
What about the refugees themselves? I'm guessing that it wouldn't necessarily be easy to get out of the area if it's surrounded.
Yeah, I mean, just to put this in perspective, that the Jenin refugee camp is home to about 18,000 people, and they have seen repeated raids by the Israeli military over the past year. But, you know, on the many occasions when I've been into the refugee camp, you see that ordinary people are suffering very much as a result of these incursions, and they can get caught up very easily in the crossfire between Palestinian militant groups and the Israeli army. As much as the Israeli army says it's trying to minimize Palestinian casualties, we know that there are already dozens of Palestinians who have been injured, and ambulances saying they're struggling to reach those inside. On top of that, you have a situation where the Israeli military has cut electricity and phone communications, so that limits the information that we're getting and also the information that can come through to the ambulances. They are asking the local Palestinian Red Crescent for a humanitarian pause, trying to coordinate that with international bodies to reach the Israeli military to try to go in and get the people who are injured.
Yolan Nell in Jenin. To France now. After days of nationwide unrest, things are beginning to calm. Riots took place for a sixth consecutive night in locations across the country, but with fewer arrests made compared with previous nights. The violence comes after the shooting last Tuesday of a 17-year-old French-Algerian teenager by a policeman during a traffic stop. Hanna Bashish is a student and a journalist, and like Nahel, French-Algerian. She's been speaking to the BBC's Sana Safi.
I feel angry and I feel scared, but I really feel angry for the protesters and with the protesters, because I do understand. I understand where the violence originated. I understand where it has taken roots, and I understand the 200 years of police brutality and police violence that has preceded it. And I think that understanding and empathy is something that we have to have if we want to stop the violence. If we want to calm down, like Macron says, we have to understand where it comes from.
What do you think is going to happen next? Are the demonstrators, those who are rioting, will they come together and work on something and prevent further violence, or what will happen?
It really ends with discussions and clear policies and measures being written. So today there are a lot of programs being written by competent people from the diaspora. I've seen it all over the weekend. The question is the government ready to listen? And I really don't think that the government is ready to listen, because the government do not think that it is doing something wrong. So the only answer that we are hearing right now is more police, but the solution is never more police. You don't stop blood by pouring more blood.
Our correspondent Chris Bachman is in Toulouse.
People are angry who are in the city centres because of what's happened. And of course, we're still seeing a lot of very angry young people, mainly men between the ages of 13 and 18, who are out to cause trouble and who are looting and who are burning cars. They're angry, but some of it also is very opportunist. I don't really see what the link is between the death of someone at a traffic violation and breaking into a Mac store in Strasbourg. The reason why I'm actually in the Toulouse city centre right now, and we'll gauge reaction from the French people, because a lot of mayors have been attacked physically, and there's been a call for people to turn out at the town halls across France. There's 35,000 mayors to give their reaction and show their support for mayors. The mayor of Toulouse, the fourth biggest city, who's very close to President Macron, has received numerous death threats in recent days.
In response to the unrest, the family of the teenager, called Nahel, are appealing for the rioters to stop and say their ongoing actions are not in his name. His grandmother said, "We don't want them to destroy shops, buses and schools. They're using Nahel as an excuse." It's been a month since Ukraine launched its counteroffensive against Russia, and so far there hasn't been much progress. President Zelensky admitted that it's going slower than desired. One of the reasons is the huge number of minefields that his forces are encountering as they advance, with many soldiers getting seriously injured or killed. Our correspondent Andrew Harding sent this report from eastern Ukraine.
Artillery fire. We're close to the front lines. In fact, the explosions you can hear in the distance are coming from just over the hill, a couple of kilometres away. This is a claymore mine they've just discovered, still active, so I think we need to probably move away. Okay, well, they've taken out the wires, they've made it safe, they're saying, and they're carrying it actually back to their car now, so I guess it must be safe. There are mines everywhere, says one of the soldiers with the call sign Dimitro. They scare me more than anything. Two of our most experienced men lost a leg each this week. The problem here is that it's not just the towns and the buildings that have been mined by the retreating Russians. It's the whole of the front line, huge fields for kilometres that have been turned into minefields. And it's making it very hard for the Ukrainians to advance at the speed they want to and that really they need to, if they're to make a strategic difference to change the course of this war. Eerie music accompanies new footage from a Ukrainian army drone. It shows soldiers trapped in a Russian minefield. You can see the explosions and the dark craters. At least three soldiers are shown in the act of stepping on mines. It's gruesome to watch, a bird's eye view of war. We've come further north now, near the town of Bakhmut, to visit some Ukrainian engineers. Some of them are building a makeshift pontoon bridge out of tree trunks.
Це особливо небезпечна міна. Вона заборонена конвенціями.
Another group is just back from the front lines. One soldier here is showing me different Russian mines that he's defused. Both sides stand accused of using illegal anti-personnel mines in this war. I'm heading to a nearby bunker to talk to the commander, Serhii Tishenko. He admits the counteroffensive is moving slowly, but that, he says, is because while Russians use their troops as cannon fodder, we're trying to advance with minimum casualties. We're using special equipment to cut paths through the minefields. Just behind the front lines, a soldier plays me a recording of intercepted Russian radio messages. There are signs of collapsing morale. This one talks about 50 Russian soldiers abandoning their positions. More video footage shows Ukrainian forces fighting their way into a network of Russian trenches outside Bakhmut. In the minefields, every step is a risk, but the counter-offensive is moving forwards nonetheless.
Andrew Harding, and there have been plenty of allegations of war crimes being committed by Russia in its offensive against Ukraine, the murder of civilians, the torture of prisoners, the list goes on. But there's one crime which international prosecutors say is the most serious of all, the crime of aggression. That's Russia's decision to invade Ukraine in the first place. And those prosecutors have just opened a new centre to find evidence of that crime in the hope that those responsible can one day be brought to justice. Now, it has a long name, the International Centre for the Prosecution of the Crime of Aggression Against Ukraine. I got more details from our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
Luckily, they've abbreviated it down to the ICPA. It's backed by the United States, the European Union, and by the International Criminal Court, as well as Ukraine itself, of course. The thing is, there are lots of different groups at the moment gathering evidence of Russian war crimes in Ukraine. And what the ICPA wants to do is to coordinate this, bring the evidence together and analyze it in the hope that one day they can bring to trial those responsible specifically for launching the invasion, making sure that invasion continued. I should say it won't be them, that the ICPA, that brings the trials. The idea is they will assist whatever court, whatever tribunal is brought in.
And why is it that this crime of aggression needs its own investigation?
Well, the International Criminal Court is currently investigating Russian war crimes. The thing is, they don't get involved, and they would be responsible for prosecuting them in future, but they don't get involved with the crime of aggression simply because it's considered to be a political issue. Who started the war? They stick to the more straightforward crimes, the murder of civilians, the torture of prisoners. So a special team was needed to investigate this thing, the crime of aggression. It was invented really as a concept after World War II, used to prosecute the leaders of Germany and Japan for starting the conflict. And at the launch today, they made it clear why they think this is so important. The EU's commissioner in charge of justice was there, Didier Reynders. He said it's not a crime against the victims alone. It's a crime against the whole international rules-based order. And also present there was Ukraine's prosecutor general, Andriy Kostin. He said the crime of aggression was the original sin because it's because of the invasion that all the other war crimes were committed. And he also picked up on that idea that unlike other war crimes, the crime of aggression, the crime of invasion, is committed not against individuals, but against the world.
Russia's aggression against Ukraine and its continuous use of force against sovereignty, territorial integrity and political independence is not only directed against my country. It stands as a global threat to peace, security and stability.
Paul, I just wanted to ask you about this inquiry itself. Is it not a bit premature to be launching something like this? Because the war, of course, is still continuing.
Yeah, it does sound premature, doesn't it? I mean, it could even sound like hubris to assume that anyone's going to be in a position to round up the Russian ringleaders and haul them off to trial. I think it's born of experience. We know that past experience that once wars end, sometimes the evidence goes missing. Their idea is that if you start gathering now the speeches, documents, intelligence reports, you get ahead. And just to make it clear, the other thing they've learned from experience, it could be very hard to pin individual war crimes on a leader. If soldiers go amok, kill civilians, how do you prove that generals and politicians back home knew about this? getting them for the crime of aggression and for launching the invasion may be the only opportunity that people have after the war to hold those leaders to account.
Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss. And still to come in the Global News podcast, why a shortage of chilies means you'll be paying a lot more for your hot sauce. Now, you might not realise, but ships produce an enormous amount of pollution through their funnels. These are a major source of the emissions that spew warming gases into the environment. Well, today, delegates from 175 countries are meeting in London to try and do something about it. I've been speaking to our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
Yeah, shipping is, I suppose, one of those hidden situations which people don't really think about. But ships carry 80 to 90% of the goods we all consume around the world. And as a result, they use huge amounts of fuel. And often the fuel they use is the, I suppose, the cheapest and the most carbon intensive fuel. So that all adds to their impact on the climate, particularly close to the Arctic, where the soot that they produce causes increased melting. So it's been a well-recognized issue for a long time. But the problem is, who owns shipping? Who are the countries responsible? So this was seen as too complex an issue to tackle in 2015 when the world came together to tackle climate change through the Paris Climate Agreement, and so shipping was kind of put on the long finger. There have been efforts over the last number of years, but this is seen as the big moment for shipping, if you like, to really grasp the nettle and to go for a long-term target of cutting emissions to net zero by the middle of the century.
Yeah, I was just wondering what's new now, really, because presumably the situation must have changed if there's hopes that something can be done. But also, you can't just go and build loads of new ships. Like you say, it has to be quite a long-term view of this.
Yeah, it has to be quite a long-term plan. And really what's changed in the last number of years is that every other sector of the world has come on board the net zero plan, if you like, including aviation, which also got a free pass at Paris in 2015. So shipping is the only sector without this regulation. They have a plan, which is to halve emissions by the middle of the century, but the science has really moved on, and that is seen as insufficient. And now a large number of countries, about 45 of them, including the US, the UK, but crucially, many developing countries, such as the Marshall Islands, from Liberia, Bahamas, other countries who are heavy into shipping, are supporting this plan to get to net zero by the middle of this century and to have tough targets along the way to ensure that everybody's doing it by 2030, by 2040. But other countries, including China particularly, are opposed to this and will want to water that down.
Yeah, that's the real question, isn't it? I suppose if you don't get some of the big players on board, how realistic is it that these ambitions will be achieved? What's your view on that? Do you think that at least there will be progress at this meeting?
I think there will be some progress. I think that what's happening is likely to be some sort of compromise where there's a long-term target agreed on net zero in some shape or form, but without those intermediate targets, and that's where the real problem is, 2030, 2040. If there's not hard targets put in for those decades, for those timeframes, people will see this as just a fudge and putting things on the long finger. So I think that will be the real measure of the success of this meeting by the end of the week.
Matt McGrath there with that wonderful turn of phrase, putting things on the long finger. Now, Thailand's royal family have opened parliament after nearly 10 years of military rule. In recent elections, the progressive Move Forward party surprised analysts by overtaking Pua Thai, formerly the biggest pro-democracy party in the country. To find out more, I spoke to our Asia correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
It's a relatively brief ceremony that's now just come to an end a little earlier, in which the king and queen address the parliament, the new members of parliament, inside a grand hall with them all standing in their parliamentary uniforms. Unusually in Thailand, for these sorts of occasions, members of parliament wear what looks very much like a military uniform, but it's not. It's a white uniform and it is their formal dress for these occasions. The king addressed the parliamentarians, and then the ceremony came to a fairly rapid conclusion because the real business gets underway on Tuesday when the new members of parliament will have to get down to the real business of choosing a new House Speaker and Deputy Speakers.
And how crucial is that House Speaker position for the Move Forward party? Because we mentioned they kind of had this huge, not even resurgence, but just a huge kind of surge in popularity.
That's right. It's very crucial because the Speaker, once Parliament gets underway, once a new Prime Minister has been selected, the Speaker has a lot of power under Thai the Thai political system over the introduction of legislation. And if Move Forward wants to get its legislative platform through Parliament, then it needs to really have control of that position. And so that's the wrangling that is going on behind the scenes, because while it is the largest party with 151 out of 500 seats, it is by no means close to a majority in the lower house, let alone, you know, the two houses of Parliament. So it has to had to form this coalition with other opposition parties like Pheu Thai, which is the old populist opposition party that has gone through several incarnations over the last 20 or 30 years. That's the second biggest party. But this is an eight-party alliance, and it still doesn't have enough guaranteed seats to elect a prime minister. So that means that they're going to have to negotiate with members of the upper house, the Senate, which was appointed during the era of military-backed rule here over the last decade. And so they're going to have to get members who are not natural, their natural allies, to come across and support them in nominating a prime minister and putting a government together over the next 2 weeks.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. Vietnam has banned the planned release of the Hollywood film Barbie in the country because it says one scene features a map that's offensive to officials in Hanoi. The map depicts China's contested territorial claims in the South China Sea. Here's our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Jason Lee.
Hey, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
The highly anticipated film features a star-studded cast, with Margot Robbie starring in the titular role of Barbie and Ryan Gosling as Barbie's love interest, Ken. It's set to be released in cinemas around the world later this month, but not in Vietnam. That's because one scene in the movie contains a map showing the U-shaped 9-dash line that China uses in maps of the South China Sea. China's controversial 9-dash line was repudiated in a ruling by a court in The Hague in 2016, but China refuses to recognize the ruling. The line shows Beijing's claims over vast areas, partly intersecting with those Vietnam considers as its own. Hanoi has repeatedly accused Beijing of violating its sovereignty in the South China Sea. The film's distributor, Warner Brothers, hasn't yet reacted to the ban. This is not the first time foreign films have been prohibited from being screened in Vietnam for depicting China's 9-dash line. In 2019, the animated film Abominable was pulled down from cinemas, and last year the action film Uncharted was banned too. And this kind of censorship has occurred on the small screen as well. In 2021, Netflix removed an Australian spy drama series Pine Gap from Vietnam for the same reason, depicting the 9-dash line.
So Barbie World doesn't include Vietnam. That was Jason Lee. And next, a drought in Mexico means that there's a shortage of chili peppers, and in particular, red jalapenos. Well, these hot vegetables are the raw material for a type of hot sauce called sriracha. The leading company which produces the condiment says production could be paused until September. Olivia Ataba reports.
Sriracha.
Sriracha sauce is a condiment made by Huy Phong Foods, a company created in 1980 by Vietnamese refugee David Tran, who lived in Los Angeles at the time. His hot sauces have become so popular around the world that the company now has a yearly revenue of $150 million. It seems that everyone likes their food spicy nowadays, but, and it's a big but, there's a problem. Huy Phong Foods have declared a red hot emergency. No more hot sauce until September. In a letter to hot sauce fans, the company said a shortage of chili peppers means they're nearly all out of their essential ingredient. The company gets its chili peppers from Mexico, harvesting £100 million worth each year, although recently there have been shortages which affects production of sriracha sauce. That's because Mexico is currently in the midst of a drought, exacerbated by climate change, which continues to threaten all its food production. The company says they will also face shortage of two other spicy sauces, sambal oleck and its chili garlic sauce. It didn't take long for people to exploit the news of shortages. Prices of sriracha have soared as high as $124 for two bottles on Amazon.
Olivia Ataba, and that is very expensive. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be another edition of the Global News podcast later on. But before you go, we are going to bring you a special artificial intelligence edition, and we want to hear your views. Do you think that AI can be taught to be caring? How would you feel being cared for by a robot, for example? And can you even imagine a world where caring roles are replaced by machines? As ever, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod, and we promise a real human being will respond. This edition was produced by Harry Bly and was mixed by Lewis Alsop. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Chris Berrow, and until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.